Speaking of reliability, friends talking about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career.
Hi, welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And this is Kirk Gray.
Hey, Kirk. You know, you haven't talked about breaking a blender lately or anything else in your house lately. Is everything working?
The last one's still running. We got a food processor, and it's lasted at least 3 weeks now.
All right,
so,
cool.
Hey, we're going a good track record here.
Yeah. Now, I remember when you I think it was you talked about, you know, using Consumer Reports and using some, you know, your history and things like that. And you would spend a little bit more money to get one that was, you know, at least the expectation was that it would be more robust, more reliable. Right. Is that a part of how you make decisions on that or not?
Well, you know, there's that perception that a more expensive product is a more possibly reliable, or there's, you know, correlation between cost and reliability.
Right. But I'm not saying that. I'm saying is that cost isn't the driver. You're not deliberately buying your wife the cheapest possible breaks, right?
No.
You're looking for reliable ones, and you still.
I'm looking for a reliable one, and if it had one switch on it,
yeah.
on, off, you know.
You'd be good.
Right, because I know the more switches it has, the more risk there is to one of those failing. It's just a numbers game.
Yep.
And
Wait a minute here, Kirk. You've for years now you've been saying how durable electronics is and how robust all this electronics is and all this stuff and
a solid state, non-moving, stationary.
Well, you put a capacitive touchpad on it, that nothing's moving. It's all electronics.
Nothing. Right. And I agree. Well, this one, but the blenders don't have those yet.
Yeah, okay.
I don't think they're using it. Probably somebody's using a LCD touchscreen and a blender or a food processor.
Yeah, I hope not.
That's a feature that's really not necessary. Yeah. And then I don't think anybody's demanding it. But the touchscreen in my car is great. I love that.
So you just hit on the topic I wanted to touch on today is that. Okay. Right. If you could find a robust, reliable blender that could grind ice all day long and only had an on-off switch, that would be great. You don't need the puree, the chop, the 15 different settings, you know, and sound effects and everything. And it reminds me of my, and I'm sure I've told this story before, is my grandmother had a washing machine at our house that was 50 plus years old. It was cast iron.
Right.
It was bolted to the floor. Mm-hmm. It had an on-off switch, mm-hmm. right? And she would set an egg timer to know when to go turn it off and put it into spin cycle or whatever it did. And it worked for years and years. And I'm telling that story at a conference to a guy I met from Whirlpool. And Whirlpool, I think it was Whirlpool, and he worked in the washer and dryer division, and he goes, but she never bought another washing machine. I says, yeah, because it worked. And he says, well, that's not good for business.
You
can't last forever.
I've experienced that directly as a sales engineer selling helium mass spectrometer leak detectors. Mm-hmm. There was a company that made one, and it was actually had vacuum tubes in it, amplification in it. And you know, I'd go to a customer, and he said, "Well, my MS-17 is still working."
Why do I need another
Mass spec. Yeah. He says, why do I need he said, I want one exactly like that one that's lasted, you know, 30 years or 20 years or some ridiculous amount of time. So the company had to start buying them back, you know, actually giving a
rebate or a buyback or trade up or whatever they call it. Yeah.
Right. And of course, they destroyed the one they got back in, make sure it never got to the field again because it just wouldn't die. So the features, I mean, there were a lot, of course, with the follow-on product. It was only a fourth of the size. It was portable. You had many handheld. You could have an extension that you you could look a handheld controller and things like that. Mm-hmm. But and it was, you know, probably as reliable, but you never know until you have a couple decades in the field to see that.
But, you know, it gets into that trade-off, though, doesn't it? This was the question I ran into a few days ago, was in the concept phase, right? We're still just barely making doesn't even look like a prototype. It's just proof of concept. Right. It's a big breadboard collage of components and trying to see, does this concept even work? We're kind of at that stage, this one client I'm working with. And the question mm-hmm. comes up is, you know, I'm there saying, hey, we need to make sure it's reliable. Here's the environment, how we're going to use it. What's the profile? What's this, that? What are the risks? Mm-hmm. How do these components stack? All that list, right?
Sure.
And the marketing guys are going, oh, but we need it to be thinner and smaller. And so now they can't cool it, or we need it to be this and that. And even the industrial design, I'm like, what? Right. What are you thinking here?
And never stops up until the day the product's released, because they've got competitors that are also introducing and have surprised you with other features that may be on their machines, you know, and on their. So
why is it that engineering teams get a design freeze, right? We say, all right, stop adding components to this or changing components. And it makes sense, right? At some point, we got to turn it over to the supply chain and manufacturing and build it. Right. But we never do that to the marketing guys. We don't do a marketing freeze. Stop it. Stop adding things. You know? Why is that?
Well, because the marketing guys are out there in the field. The marketing guys are dealing with the customers, especially the salespeople. They're out there directly with the customers. They're hearing the feedback. They're hearing the desires. They know that, you know, it would be nice to have this on that product, or a competitor has had this feature. And the customer said, well, that looks cool, even though they may have not even used that feature yet on their competitor's product. So there's this constant pressure. It's just like when you tell a sales engineer, you know, about a new product, he doesn't want to sell the old product. He wants to sell the new improved product. Mm-hmm. And so it's a very tough time for, especially those guys in sales, because you don't come back to the customer for the second time or third time with the same product that you had. You want to bring him something new. So that's,
unless it's that old mass spec thing you were talking about that lasts for 30 years, that'd sell itself. Yeah. You know, you got to have it.
Right. And there was a huge aftermarket for that product, for those old products.
Now, I think there's a sliding scale here that I think most organizations get. If you add a major new feature, right, it's going to take a bunch of work and more software and everything else to make it work late in the program, and you don't change when you ship it, the risk goes up that you'll get something wrong and ship a poor performing product. It have low reliability. Right. I think that's intuitive, right?
Intuitive. And if you've introduced something, if something's come late that you want to add into the design, it's probably, there's a very good chance that it's a new technology or a new you know, like touchscreen, a new way of doing something that has a higher than a mature, you know, may not be a mature technology yet.
Right. And if it's not, even if it is a mature technology, our team may not know how to
right. If you've never dealt with that,
it's new.
Interfaced with it, known its quirkiness, or what about, you know, some EMI issues that it may have or something like that. You never know.
But if you take that same idea, that same feature you want to add late in a program, but you start it up in concept phase, or you start it even mm-hmm. before the product is conceived of, and you develop it, that technology, build maturity, then you got an ideal case where you go, oh, yeah, we can add that, and it gets built right in. And it significantly reduces the risk to hitting the reliability problems. It doesn't eliminate it. It just minimizes it. It's a different investment pattern.
Right.
Now, where's that flip over, right? Where's that? If I'm in the throes of developing a product, at what point when marketing comes up and says, hey, look, we wanted to do Y, X, Z, not X, Y, Z. And you're like, okay, how do I assess this to say, here's the risk? And I don't have hard numbers. I don't have time to do an experiment. They don't have hard numbers. They have three conversations with two customers, right?
Right.
how do we balance that and compare apples and oranges in this case?
Yeah, that's a tough one, Fred. I think that, you know, you've got to decide how important that feature or function is. Second, you know that the product's not going to be that's the last product you're ever going to produce unless it is. You're closing the company. You say, well, that's the last one we'll do. But you're going to have an iteration. You're going to have another follow-on product, an improved product. And, you know, you can also put that decision on adding that feature at, you know, the iPhone 6S, you know, add another model or next generation. And that
That's a good point. Is you can modify, you can mitigate the risk by adding it as a second model or an add-on feature for those that just want it. Right. You can experiment with it. It adds complexity to your manufacturing and supply chain and the design. I mean, I've seen it one time where a group would add the feature but not turn it on. It was all the products were exactly the same, but if a product has a hidden feature by software, we say this is model X and it doesn't have those features, so it just doesn't have it turned on.
And by the volume cost discount, it's not a lot of money to add that feature and not turn it on for all the product.
That's right.
And then add that as a premium. Okay.
Right. We'll versus having two different inventories, two different manufacturing processes.
Supply chain. Make them all the same and then add the features as you can buy on them.
And that may or may not work for any, but there's a balance between the business processes and supply chain management and manufacturing processes and instruction manuals and everything else that goes into delivering a product, right?
Sure.
But then it's and that's all got cost versus just add the feature and hope it works.
Right.
Setting expectations, right? So all of these different things are going on, and reliability is just a piece of informing that information. So if it's perceived as a high risk, it's new technology, it's new to us. It's not mature. All the red flags go up, right? We're going to say, hey, and this is a problem.
Right. And the physics of what you know about that device or subsystem, you make your best guess and start stressing that by itself, maybe. If it's a switch or a new kind of, you know, membrane switch or something like that, you start testing early that component, you know, the thing that may have some concern wear out. But if it's a lot of course with software and microprocessor systems is a lot of the interface to driving motors, pumps, sensors, you know, reading and things like that.
It's getting all that logic to work with the existing systems. And that might be the best case scenario, Kirk, is it's kind of in the middle. It's look for that opportunity, say, well, what do we not know, whether it's about the marketing of this or about the reliability of it, and what can we do to fill in that gap? But because there's a couple of patterns that occur, even if it's in concept phase or late, we go, hey, look, if you add this feature and turn it on, the thing explodes and melts onto the floor, right? I think there's a Dilbert cartoon about that, right? Do we really want to ship that? And let's make sure that that information's available at the point when we can say go or no go on this, right?
Right.
And sometimes you don't have a lot of time, and sometimes you got a lot of time. But it's at least say, here's where the risks are. Let's get some evidence to support a decision on it.
Right.
And balance that. But if you're just sitting there at the table and you have to go thumbs up or thumbs down on it, it doesn't help when we just say, well, it depends. If it works, it's great. That'd be wonderful. If it doesn't work, it'd be horrible. And our warranty would go through the roof.
But I think that's where, again, stress testing can help find it real quick. That's the whole idea, is you've got to find out things real quick. You don't have time. You don't have, you know, get 35 samples and set them all for running for months. You've got to go quick with those kinds of changes if you find a new technology. So, yes, It's you know, a big complex thing of the market, what market you're addressing, how rapidly it's changing, like the phone, smartphone mm-hmm. market. You know, everybody's adding all kinds of features. Some of them, like 3D, didn't sell. Some of them did.
Yeah. Oh, did you see the announcement that came out, I think, yesterday? I think it's Samsung has a folding phone. And I thought, we've been doing flip phones for years, but this one folds.
Yeah.
$1,800? Are they crazy?
Yeah, really. I mean, what's the benefit? We'll have to see. They'll have to explain the benefit a little better. I think it's actually this folding screen, or that's the issue, I think.
Right. Yeah, that's what I think it is. But I don't know if it's foldable everywhere, if it's on a hinge, or I haven't seen any details of it. I did see a video of a TV at Comdex this year, at CEX or whatever it's called, where it was in a box on the table. Just a low rise box sitting on the table, and you say, turn on the TV, and the box opens up and the screen moves up like a flexible white screen, but it's a OLED TV.
Yeah. It says, here it is. It says Galaxy Fold is available in April, starting at $1,980.
Oh, wow. Man.
Yeah. That's why I say, what are you getting from that?
Okay. Oh, I'd like a good back, you know, massage treatment on my back.
No, it's a folding screen. If you look at the video on the internet, you see that he actually opens up what looks like a two-part flip phone, except the screen is completely without a line in the middle, a full, looks like a tablet size.
Okay.
So you got this phone that folds into a kind of a tablet. Or half of a tablet into a full tablet.
Oh, right.
And it looks like I don't know how they do it, but I'm looking at the video right now, and there's no line showing a crease where the fold is. Pretty amazing.
Yeah,
I think
cool.
It may have more useful applications other places than just a phone. So let's just say they're kind of presenting, and certainly they'll get a lot of feedback, and the field where they can use this, and it might be very beneficial in some places. But yeah, that I'd say that's a big risk. You know, how many times can you fold it? Because we know materials fatigue. It doesn't matter that you say, yeah, you've got a lot of fatigue. Eventually you will, because you're bending a material. If that's the case, this is not a hinge.
Well, how elastic is it, right? You know, how is it well within the elastic region for all of the materials in that fold? And I think we'll find out, because, you know, like the new iPhone came out and somebody stuck it in their pocket and sat on it and goes, hey, look, it bends. And, well, is it still working? Yeah, it's still working, but it bent.
Well, we know it bends, but how much and how sensitive is that bending? And I thought there was a great Consumer Reports showed a video of them using a very good, what would be considered a halt type methodology in actually putting pressure on the phone in the middle and bending it and comparing that between different makers of the phones and what kind of how many pounds of pressure did it take. And obviously, it was still significant. And in all cases, we do know that customers will take a point of a product to stress a product to a point of not reasonable survival. Yeah. So, you know, that's just a fact of the product. But, you know, I guess that with any new tech like this folding screen and a feature like that, you'd say, well, what does the customer get out of it? I guess in this case, he goes from a regular size phone to a full size tablet and can carry a folded phone.
Yeah.
And so space saving, maybe.
Yeah,
and,
it's cool, right? I'm not going to spend that much money because it's cool, although I have for other products. But yeah, it's going to be, I think, now back to our earlier discussion, do you think that was not added at the last minute? I don't think they sprung that on the engineers 2 months ago and said, oh, we're going to do this folding thing.
This phone was probably built around that technology. Once they discover you find a way of bending a screen and not breaking it or whatever they're doing, then they said, well, let's build a phone that has this capability. So
yeah.
that's a the reason a new feature is, or the feature actually drives the rest of the major product.
Feature. I think you're right. It's probably on the line of a concept car, and they're trying to figure out where and how this is a market because they have a technology leading deal, and it might find a home someplace. But can you imagine the owner's manual, the spec sheet for it? Because only fold it once per year, slowly at, you know, and this rate per minute in this particular temperature. Don't do it when it's below 20 degrees.
Those are all really good questions, Fred. I would love to hear Samsung explain what is the limit, or what is your distribution of limits, you know, where you've reached the folding maximum. You know, some of them do 1,000 and one does, you know, or is it from 200 to the best have done 1,200, you know, folds? You know, what's the comparison? What's the distribution? Yeah. All that data, cold, and you just pointed out, cold and hot.
Yeah.
That's going to change the flexibility and a
lot of. Is it powered or not powered?
All that.
Yeah. No, I think there'll be people looking at it. That'd be interesting. We'll have to follow that and do another episode on it.
Yeah. We'll see what new technologies come up with. But, you know, everybody's got to, because again, we've talked about you have to come up with a better technological feature. And that's hopefully why you're selling your phones, is the previous phones failed because they got worn out, or they were just, you know, they weren't manufactured correctly. And so, you know, your customer's probably not going to buy your brand after that. But
it's a balance. And we're assuming that Samsung didn't spring the foldable technology on their engineers 2 months ago and then said, ship it. And we're, you know, and I think you made a good point, Kirk, is they probably had the technology and said, well, let's put this in our line and let's sort it out. Because they're taking a risk. They know that it's got to work for at least some duration. So I think that was more thought through.
A big risk.
Well, there's that too.
$2,000.
Yeah, that's a part of it. But it's something we face every day, though, right? Every product we work on, there's even the initial feature set presents a range of risks, and we want to influence what we put into a product and eventually design, and or what we need to learn along the way. And it's a variable. It's constantly moving. It's constantly changing. But I think having thought through, well, what do you do in these circumstances? And what's your plan of attack to either get more information? And HALT fits in this, is to get quick information when it makes sense. So that's all good. So let's hand off to our listeners. And, you know, what's your bet on the Samsung phone? How long do you think they'll last? How many bends?
How many folds?
How many folds will it go before it stops? What's the user manual advise people to do? But more realistically is, you know, how do you deal with the feature creep that happens in nearly every program? But how do you balance that? How do you work with your team so that reliability is a part of that discussion? Because it's certainly can be, not always, but it certainly can present a significant risk to the product's reliability, even with what would seemingly be an innocent ad at the last minute. It can really disrupt things. So it's a constant battle we have. So head over to ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR, and we'd love to hear from you. What's your story in this area?
Sure, because that's the way we get a better show and podcast, is by getting your feedback. So let us know what you think. And if you've had any, you know, last minute design changes that have been disasters, that would be interesting to know.
Yeah, that'd be good. Oh, also, if you know of a blender that has an on-off switch and just lasts for 30 years.
it's probably a 1940s Oster blender or something that's still going
out
there.
It's cast iron, yeah.
Well, some of those ones the commercial industry made were pretty robust back then.
Yeah, no, yeah. We'll have to see if anybody knows one. Send it, get a line for you there. All right.
Okay.
Well, cool, Kirk. We'll talk to you again.
Okay, Fred. Thanks. Good to talk to you.
Yeah. Cheers. Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation if you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show. Please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.